I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome David Zweig. David is the acclaimed author of Invisibles, a book that questions our society's assumptions about professional success and happiness. He's written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, among other publications. David is a former professional musician, a novelist, and he has lectured about the intersection of media technology and psychology at conferences, universities, and corporations in the U.S. and Europe. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
David, you have a really interesting background, really fascinating. What have been some of your biggest successes?
My biggest successes? It depends how you define success, but I spent about a decade playing music professionally, and a lot of it was incredibly rewarding. Worked with some incredibly talented and well-regarded producers, so that would be a big success, I would consider. And then just fortunately, my writing career the past few years has been going in a direction that I'm excited about, just writing for The Atlantic and The Times. I recently did a thing for The Wall Street Journal and a bunch of other places, Salon, et cetera, Slate. And with the publication, but I'd say I guess the peak of it is the publication of my book that came out recently, Invisibles, that, you know, the reason we're chatting here today. I would say that's probably my biggest kind of real overt success.
Mm-hmm. And how do you define success, since you mentioned that?
I mean, you know, there's the sort of squishy answer, you know, the self-helpy, you know, answer of how it's I guess how you define success correlates with how do you define happiness, et cetera. So, you know, success, but they all sort of intertwine. But success is being able to, if you're an individual, being able to earn a living that's of an amount of money that feels sufficient for whatever it is, the lifestyle that someone wants to lead, yet doing so while you're doing work that you find rewarding. If I wanted to just make money, I certainly wouldn't have tried to pursue a career as a writer. That's how I would define it, which is a little bit similar to how the Invisibles in my book define success, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell us more about that. How do the Invisibles define success?
So my book, Invisibles, and the subtitle is The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. It is about these people whom I call Invisibles, and ultimately they're not an exclusive group. It's not like you either are or aren't an invisible. We all have characteristics of these people I call invisibles that they embody. It's just simply the people in the book are really at the far end of a spectrum we all fall upon. But these people, I define them as people who are highly skilled professionals whose work is really critical to whatever endeavor they're a part of, but who go largely unnoticed by the public, and who are not big self-promoters. In fact, many of them are quite ambivalent toward gaining recognition. That's really their core trait that they all share, which I think a pretty extended and persuasive case that to not be a big self-promoter, to be ambivalent about gaining attention for oneself, is really the antithesis, it seems, of our culture, of the ethos today, where gaining attention seems to be valued above nearly everything else. And in the book, I explore a number of people. I do these really long form profiles where we get to see their success at work. I meet up with them at their jobs, at their workplace. I'm in China with this guy, Dennis Poon, who is a structural engineer on skyscrapers at the Shanghai Towers, the second tallest building in the world. After all, everyone here, if you see a grand building, you think of the architect, or starchitect, as it were. You never think of the engineers. Yet without the engineers, and particularly so on these extremely tall, super tall buildings, they call them. It's the technical term, actually. These skyscrapers, without the engineers, these buildings wouldn't stand. So this guy really is an invisible. And Dennis, the man who I profile in the book, here's a guy who is, he is on the board of directors of a global engineering firm. He's in charge of just huge teams of workers on these multi-billion dollar projects. This is a really, really important and senior role in highly orchestrated and expensive endeavors. And yet here's a guy who basically prefers to be seen as part of a team. Whenever I asked him a question about himself, he invariably answered "we" instead of "I." And I just thought it was incredibly powerful. And I found, incidentally, that sort of semantic tick of "we" versus "I." I found that common among invisibles I interviewed and met with across a really wide range of industries. And again, these are people, the people I chose for the book, these are people who are at the really the top of their fields. So what they show is another path toward success, that you don't need to be this big blustery kind of self-promoter, someone who's taking all the, you know, energy in the room toward themselves in order to become successful. In fact, quite the contrary, that these people got to where they are and by viewing themselves as members of a team, by being master collaborators, by being very humble and having a lot of humility, yet still being highly ambitious, that you can marry these traits together. And what I show also, and what I cite a lot of research in the book about this as well, is that there's a lot of evidence to support the notion that companies with these types of people, invisibles, in leadership roles, that being an invisible doesn't mean you technically are invisible. Again, it's about embodying the traits that I talk about in the book these people have, that these that companies that have these types of people in their executive ranks, and even in specifically the CEO, tend to outperform companies who are led by more extroverted type of workers and people who are seeking more attention for themselves.
You know, as someone who actually started his professional career as an engineer, I can certainly relate to this, the characteristic that you're describing, particularly among technical professionals. I saw it quite a lot. And interestingly enough, among leaders, this is something we've observed, and we've posted a few blog articles, especially around the issue of charisma and do leaders have to be charismatic. And in fact, there are some great examples of leaders who were not at all charismatic, but very successful leaders of big companies.
Yeah. And you know, I would certainly believe that to be the case. You know, I have to say, a number of the people I met with, I would describe them as charismatic, or I certainly wouldn't describe them as not charismatic necessarily, though some of them did tend to be quite shy. It was more just a matter of this really fascinating mindset that they have that seems, in my experience, to be quite different from the broader culture and broader business culture today, that these people became successful and tend to elevate the rest of the workers around them by being more of a collaborator, or viewing themselves more as part of the team and being more interested in the larger enterprise than they were in really seeking attention for themselves.
And have you seen examples among this people with this characteristic that have impacted how they deal with successes and failures?
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting is that, again, you know, these, you would think it to be the opposite, but this trait, when you are focused on the larger enterprise, and I find this really, it's surprising and encouraging, but the evidence seems to show, you know, what the people in my book themselves, I let their profiles, I let these, their stories, the narratives of these people speak for itself. And that to me is the most compelling way of making the case, but I also buttress these narratives with quite a bit of research from psychologists, business scholars, and others, that this approach really does correlate with success. And one of the reasons is, it seems fairly obvious, but it's that when people are focused more on their work and less on promotion, of course, the work is going to benefit from that. And the nice thing is, though, this part that I was saying is encouraging, is that good work does tend to get recognized. So that we think that, you know, we all sort of, including myself, have this fear that if you're doing something really well, you know, how are people going to know? I need to really get out there. And obviously, different types of work and different professions, we all have different times when we, in different ways that we need to promote ourselves and our work. You know, I'm talking with you right now as a form of promotion for my book. So it's not, but, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I talk about that in the book. This isn't saying that promotion is bad or something. And the people in my book are not doormats. These are not meek people who are kind of, you know, just hiding in the corner. So it's not about saying you can just put your head down and do your work and never, you know, step out there when you need to. But what these people do show is that the majority of your time, if it's just spent on the work and not thinking about that other elements of gaining notice, really has a strong correlation with success. And I think what the evidence shows, and I think we all sense this on just kind of like an intuitive level, is that there's far too much attention today being placed on promotion. And not that this thing that it's out of balance today, that there's too much time and effort being spent on trying to raise your profile or build a platform, all these different kind of key phrases that we're hearing thrown around today, particularly, you know, the use of social media. All that stuff has a place. But what I argue, and I think I make a pretty persuasive case about this, is that We've been fed a bit of a myth here about the amount that we need to be doing that and its correlation with success. I'm trying to dial things back a little bit here.
Right. So we've been sacrificing quality of content for quantity of promotion.
Yeah, I think that certainly is the case, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support this, you know, in kind of a real empirical way via, you know, different studies. But I think we all can kind of just see this, you know, just being in the culture, the amount of effort that is placed on promotion, and there's a whole industry of, you know, experts in marketing and social media stuff, who are constantly beating the drum about, you know, raising your profile and why it's so critical to spend time on doing so. And what I, you know, and just the whole notion of, like, even when you think about gender roles with, like, lean in, you need to, you know, with the recent book that came out, I sort of say lean back, don't lean in so much. You know, look at these people in my book who are all very successful, and they also happen to be really fulfilled, most of them, with their work, and they got there by not by leaning in for the most part, but by leaning back and by not worrying about being the loudest voice in the room.
Mm-hmm. Who's an example that our leaders? I'm sorry. Who's an example that our listeners might recognize? Who is someone who you might characterize as invisible, but who's a really successful leader?
Well. I think by the fact that they tend to be invisibles, the listeners aren't going to know who they are. And that's why, you know, I chose people who really are doing primarily behind the scenes work, you know, so unlike a Dennis Poon, who I found to just be so fascinating. A lot of these people are the people who really kind of make the world work. The things that we see, smell, you know, hear and experience, these people, we don't think of them, but yet they're critical. And the people specifically in the book who I chose were people who really made it to the top of their respective fields. And it's like, and because I wanted to deconstruct, well, how did they get there? And are there any threads that bind these people together?
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any particular threads in who is part of their team and who helps them in their rise to success?
Well, the thread is this notion of kind of subjugating oneself to something larger than yourself. And that is the core trait that they have. This ambivalence toward recognition, they just not seeking attention for oneself in the way that it seems so many of us do. And that's the thing that I found across every industry that I profile here with someone. One of the people in the book is a guy named Robert Elswit. You probably aren't familiar with his name, but it's likely you may have seen some of his films. He's worked on, except for one, every Paul Thomas Anderson film, you know, Boogie Nights. He won the Oscar for There Will Be Blood. He's also worked on some really big commercial films like some in the Bourne franchise and the Mission Impossible franchise. Here's a guy who's incredibly successful. He is paid very handsomely for his work. And, you know, I thought he was going to be this big kind of Hollywood big shot. I didn't mention he's a cinematographer. So we're familiar with the director, of course. And in the book, I start off his chapter saying, quick, name five movie directors. Okay, now name one cinematographer. You know, and unless you're a film buff, you probably were stumped with that question. But the notion is, this guy, his personal stamp is really on these films that we see. And no one after the director has arguably a larger impact on the look and feel of a film than the cinematographer. Yet, of course, he is largely invisible or unknown to the public. And that's fine with him. He doesn't care about, you know, his goal isn't to one day be a director or something. This is his goal. He's doing what he wants to do. And he works on, you know, when you see that large scroll of names at the end of a film and you're, you know, wondering who all those people are and what they do, a large number of them are under this guy's charge. They were the grips and the gaffers and such. They work under, ultimately, underneath the umbrella of the cinematographer. And this guy could have a big Hollywood attitude and this whole thing. And it turns out, I met up with him and I was on set with him and through a series of interviews, this guy is incredibly personable. He's very humble. Yet, as I mentioned before, he's also ambitious. And he treats everyone there with the utmost respect. And he realized that's how you get the most out of people. He said, listen, if I have to get people to show up to work every day and perform at their best, I know I'm not going to get that by yelling at them. I want them to show up and want to be here. So it's amazing. Here's a guy who's reached his really the pinnacle of his field. And he got there by really worrying about being a collaborator and by being respectful to these large teams of workers that who are below him, and then also being respectful and a collaborator to his, you know, ultimately who'd be considered his boss, the director. Mm-hmm. So he's an artist in his own right. So, you know, so I call his chapter, it's the singular vision and the art of collaboration. So to be, he really has mastered this notion of being true to your own vision and what you're doing, but yet also being a master collaborator. And it's a real skill to be able to do that, to kind of feel like you still have your own self and your own stamp on the larger project, yet simultaneously not feel the need to push your own stamp, you know, on everyone else, and particularly on, you know, I guess who ultimately is kind of the lead person on whatever the project or business may be. And this guy is, he's figured out how to do it. And that's brought him to his place in the field.
David, our show Smashing the Plateau is all about how you get past roadblocks. So like, you know, when you personally are stuck, or when your team is stuck, or your organization is stuck, especially if there have been successes along the way, you know, how do you get past that and get the team or the organization to the next level? Are there traits that you've noticed in individuals you would call invisibles that might clue us in as to ways you can become unstuck and smash the plateau?
Well, yeah, I think the whole approach they have whether it's an ongoing thing or whether it's about smashing the plateau, really has a strong correlation with success and with moving forward with what you're doing and achieving well, both as individuals but also as organizations, that when they embody this kind of approach. So the first one is this trait I keep talking about, this notion of get people to, you know, change the culture, where it depends how large of an organization you have, but where the organization itself or the people within it or even the organization itself, if you think about, you know, advertising and such, again, we as people, or we as, you know, as different businesses or organizations, all need to promote ourselves and our work at different times and in different circumstances. But I think, and I think there's a fear in that we have to do this extreme amount of promotion or we're going to get lost. But what the evidence seems to show is that great work gets noticed, and that you're better off putting the efforts into your R&D and less and shifting funds away from your marketing and your ad budget. You know, I'm not a business guru, but this is really what I found after spending several years with people who are very, very successful and, you know, have been part of very large organizations. Like I mentioned, a Dennis Poon who works on billion dollar, you know, skyscrapers around the world. These are people with pretty important roles in big projects and enterprises. And although, by the way, as an aside, not everyone in my book was part of a giant enterprise. Many of them worked alone as well. But what they show is that you're both as a person, if you think of yourself as a business or a business itself, that there really needs to be a shift in the ratio or proportion of money and resource and effort put toward promotion back toward, you know, I guess what I could broadly call R&D, the work itself. Focus on the work. Another trait that all these people have is meticulousness. And I saw it again and again that these people just have a real devotion to detail. And you might think that that's tedious at times to be meticulous. But in fact, you may be familiar with the psychological phenomenon called flow. But what these people show is that when you really get into the details and they're not seen as a burden or something to gloss over, but to really kind of like revel in these details and to focus on them and be meticulous, that people get into this flow state, you know, what someone might call being in the zone or something like that. And I saw this again and again, where it creates this really deep, pleasurable experience for work. It's not pleasure as in happiness necessarily, but something richer and deeper in like the Greek sense, you know, ancient Greek philosophical sense of the rich life. And so I think that type of attitude of devoting yourself to the details and really caring about the minutiae of something has a really strong correlation with success.
So maybe if you're stuck, what you should do is spend less time worrying about what people think about you and spend more time with your team devoting time to the details of improving the quality of your product or service and finding out what's not working so well with your product or service.
Do great work. If you're providing a product or service, you know, and obviously every organization has a different profile as to what makes sense for them as far as advertising, but you know, word of mouth is very powerful. And people, and you know, or rather repeated business with someone, or they pass it on with word of mouth, that doing excellent work is the best advertisement you can get for yourself. This sounds obvious to a degree. You know, it's like, I don't need to be told that, but yet we do. That's the thing, is that, again, I go back to these, you know, marketing, you know, quote unquote experts and these social media experts. It is really being pounded into us. There's a lot of pressure both on a personal level and also organizational level, you know, that businesses need to do this, that the emphasis based on raising a profile, on building more and more, followers on social media. And a lot of that stuff, these are just fake metrics. And you end up spinning your wheels, putting so much effort into that type of thing, when you really would be better off putting your efforts into the work itself. One of the people who I interviewed in the book was this freelance writer who's a guy who's pretty successful. He's written for The Atlantic and some other prominent publications. And he was talking about how he spent years trying to build up his social media presence. He got a lot of Twitter followers, in the thousands, I think. And then what he realized, though, was over time, he said that having a lot of followers doesn't get you good work. Good work gets you a lot of followers.
David, where would you place yourself on the invisible scale?
Well, you know, as a writer, I'm visible. You know, my name is on the cover of my book, and I'm happy to have it there. I have a byline when I write articles. But what I learned while writing the book and researching and meeting with these people was that we all can embody some of these traits. And I found that my own sense of fulfillment and I think success to a large degree has been affected by trying to embody some of the traits that these people have. So even though I'm in a more visible role, by focusing more on the work and less on gaining attention has both made me do better work and also brought me a lot more satisfaction. It's just, it's very fleeting, the feeling we get from gaining attention. It doesn't last, but and it feels great, and there's nothing wrong with being recognized. It feels nice, but we have to recognize that's really, you know, that dangling carrot, you know, that you're chasing. You're never going to really reach it. It always fades. But what doesn't fade, what is a deep and lasting fulfillment, is when you really are engaged with the work itself. And that's kind of the biggest thing I got from researching, that I learned from working with these people.
And do you find that for yourself, the recognition of that has helped you smash your own plateau?
Jeez, I think I'm still working on smashing my plateau. Well, for me, you know, I recount the story in the book about how I had recently gotten the book deal. I wrote an article for The Atlantic that was kind of the precursor to the book, and it got a lot of attention. There are a bunch of agents who wanted to work with me, a number of publishers who I was meeting with who were interested in, you know, buying the book on the proposal. And I was excited. This is great. You know, this is great news for a writer. That's certainly a place you want to be in. And for a while, I was thrilled to be able to tell friends, or I'd meet people at a party, you know, oh, I got this book deal with Penguin, blah, blah, blah. This is terrific. And it felt great. But then inevitably, that feeling would go away, you know, after a few minutes or the next day. And I couldn't ride on that. And I started to become anxious about the amount of work that was lay ahead of me. And I had met with one of the people who are one of the big profiles in the book, and I had this enormous transcript that I had to go through. I mean, we're talking about something like, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 words, which is like 100 pages long, you know, because a transcript can really run that long when you're talking with someone for 2 or 3 hours straight, you know, and then multiple times. So I'm running through, and I was dreading going through this transcript, but I knew it had to be done. And I just kind of dug in. And all of a sudden I look up and it was already dark outside, you know, and I spent the whole day on this thing that I really didn't want to do. And it was pretty tedious work at times. And I'm walking home and it's like 11 o'clock at night at this point. And I just had this like kind of eureka moment. I was like, wow, it's like I am experiencing the whole point of what this book is about. This notion that I stopped thinking about the attention I was getting from friends or people. And instead, I just kind of dug into the work, even though it was something I didn't want to do. And it was the best I had felt in a long time, far better than I felt being able to kind of like brag to someone about a book deal, that this kind of deeper sense of satisfaction. So that was in some way smashing of a plateau, of breaking through on this project, of just like figuring out how to, you know, when you're writing a book, you know, it's just a massive undertaking to figure out how to shape this thing. Where do you put all the pieces together? How do you form a narrative so it's compelling for someone to read and has momentum? It's not about just, you can't just sit down and write. You know, writing a book that's actually flows and is enjoyable to read and makes sense and has a structure to it is an enormously complicated task. And I couldn't make heads or tails of it. And this was a way, I think, that did smash the plateau. It was just kind of just digging into the work.
You know, actually, it's a really important point because people who are in leadership roles, including CEOs of big companies, feel very much alone. They have fears, they have anxieties, just like what you just described. And the truth is that satisfaction, when it comes, is really self-recognized. It's not about what others think of you; it's what you think of yourself.
That's right. And of course, you know, we're all being judged, and I would imagine particularly a CEO. So it's not about, hey, as long, it's not like some hokey thing of like, as long as you feel good, then everything, you know, it's going to be okay. It's not about that. It's not something, you know, pat like that. This is about focusing on excellence, doing the work, and that ultimately that does get recognized. Again, I find this like an incredibly encouraging and heartening discovery that I had in working on the book, that I found that both I saw that, you know, most compellingly through the profiles, but also through a lot of research from business scholars and others that show this to be the case. Again, it doesn't mean that you can just hide in the corner, do your work. There are times that you can't just be a doormat, but that really focusing on the work and less on kind of the outer image and all that stuff, that really has the strongest correlation with achievement.
So, David, what do you think is next for you?
I'm talking about Invisibles for a while more, which has been really fun, and I'm doing quite a bit of lecturing for different organizations, both the nonprofit sector and as well as for-profit companies primarily, at universities. So I'm enjoying that. I have a big lecture coming up with a bunch of at a meeting of HR executives. It's this large annual conference. So I'll be speaking to 300 or 400 kind of top HR executives about the role of Invisibles and the management challenges they can present. So I'm doing a bit of that. And then I'm also working on some other kind of slowly developing my next book projects and some other stuff as well.
So, you know, we typically, towards the end of our interview, we ask this question about who you know who's doing something you're excited about. And why so?
Right. Well, I'll tell you, there, you know, in my work, there are a number of academics who I've interacted with, and the people who I find most exciting, a guy named Evan Selinger is one of them. There are a few others who are in the academy, but who really seek to engage with the broader public. I think there is, for quite some time now, there's been this kind of there's been a bit of a, or more than a bit, of a negative connotation for scholars to write for sort of more mainstream publications, that they're supposed to just kind of function in this bubble, or, you know, the term that people talk about is the ivory tower. And it's really a systematic problem in the academy today. But there are a number of people who are really breaking out of that, where they seek to be, you know, what we used to have, what we would call public intellectuals. So again, you know, one of them who I know personally is a guy named Evan Selinger, but there are many of them now. But people who are really, in particular, operate in this space about technology and media and how that affects us and the culture at large and as workers and just as people. And a lot of their research, you know, is a bit eggheady, and, you know, where they dig into stuff that's might be in the philosophical realm. But then they also take the time to write for The Atlantic, for Wired, for, you know, Salon or places like that. And that to me is really exciting. I'm not an academic, but I love learning things from them. But things oftentimes need to be framed in a manner that regular people, quote unquote, can understand. That anyone who's doing all of our work should have some relevance to everyone, you know. And these, that if you really operate in such a bubble that you're not able to make your work relevant to other people, or at least understandable to regular people, I think that can be a sign that maybe you're doing something wrong.
Great. Well, David, this brings us to the close of our interview. Today's guest has been David Zwarg, author of the new book Invisibles and former musician. David, thank you for joining me today on Smashing the Plateau.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.